What I'm doing in my two sessions is doing a response to a book written by Kenneth Gentry entitled The Beast of Revelation. And what he says in this book is that the beast is someone that's already, you know, come to pass in world history. And he identifies the beast as Nero. There's no future Antichrist. And what Gentry does in this particular book is he takes what's called the preterist perspective. And I'm assuming that most people here know what preterism is. If you've listened to Tommy Ice for any degree of time, you run into the issue of preterism. Preterism says that the prophecies found in the book of Revelation and elsewhere have already found their fulfillment. So these prophecies were futuristic at the point that the words of the book were written, but from our viewpoint, here in 2003, these prophecies have already come to pass. And preterism is not monolithic. There are different branches and strands of preterism. We're only critiquing one type here in my two presentations. The specific type of preterism advocated by Gentry is the idea that the book of Revelation was written in the 60s, the mid-60s. He dates the book about 64 or 65 A.D. And the prophecies contained therein came to pass just a few years later in the final years of Nero's reign. And ultimately, the prophecies, most of them anyway, were fulfilled with the destruction of Jerusalem in A.D. 70. And you say, well, this is just a silly idea. Obviously, no one believes it. Why should we, you know, waste our time talking about it? But the fact of the matter is, and I thought these ideas were crazy when I first encountered them myself, but the fact of the matter is these ideas seem to be getting some traction in the evangelical community. Just to give you an example, back in October, Hank Hanegraaff had on his radio show a very outspoken preterist named Gary DeMar, who Tommy has debated on a number of occasions. And this particular individual was given two full program links to disseminating these types of ideas. And if you've ever run into R.C. Sproul's ministry, which most people do at some point, you're bound to run into Gentry's interpretation of the Beast of Revelation, because Sproul gives Gentry's conclusions a blanket endorsement. So although these ideas seem strange at first glance, they seem to be getting some traction in the evangelical community. And if you're a pastor, it's likely that members of your congregation have already run into this particular view. And if you spend any time on the internet, you're bound to run into preterist websites and those types of things. They're growing in popularity. So that's kind of what we're going after here in these two sessions, as we do a futurist response, or how would a futurist respond to Gentry's book, The Beast of Revelation. Let me just tell you a little bit, if I could, about Gentry's pre-understanding. Pre-understandings are ideas that we bring to the Bible. Sometimes our pre-understandings are correct and are affirmed by the Bible, but generally speaking, all of us bring to the Bible all kinds of mental baggage that's wrong and inaccurate, and the biblical text needs to correct our pre-understanding. And so what is Gentry's pre-understanding? Well, it's this idea that the church is going to experience long-term cultural progress and is actually going to be successful in Christianizing culture. And I wish that it was true. Unfortunately, it's not true. And the only reason I know it's not true is because it's not supported by the pages of Scripture. The kingdom age is not... Oh, here we go, a microphone. Praise the Lord. Save my vocal cords.
Yes.
The kingdom age... Is that a little bit better? Is not something that the church will usher in. the kingdom age will be ushered in after Christ returns. And you get that from a literal understanding of the book of Revelation. Christ comes back in Revelation chapter 19, and then in chapter 20, following it chronologically, the kingdom age is ushered in. And so this idea that the church is going to Christianize culture, the church is going to, you know, subdue culture in the long run, the church, the idea that the church will actually be successful in setting up the kingdom, is an interesting philosophy, but it really is not a biblical philosophy. And so what Gentry does, instead of allowing the text to correct his pre-understanding, he ends up ridiculing our view, which is the premillennial view, which is the view I just said, that Christ comes back first and the kingdom age starts. He ends up ridiculing that particular point of view. And so, for example, he will call us, you know, pessimillennialists. Or he will refer to our particular eschatology as pessimistic eschatology because we don't believe we're going to usher in the kingdom. We're pessimists. Maybe I'm a little old-fashioned, but I think only Christ is going to be able to usher in his own kingdom. I don't think it's something man can bring about. And because we haven't bought into his view, he ridicules us as pessimists and pessimillennialism. So here's a quote here. He says, "It is my deep conviction that much of the decline of the influence of Orthodox Christianity on our culture is due to a pervasive pessimistic eschatology." And in that same paragraph, he goes on to quote the two people that he considers to be the greatest proponents of pessimistic eschatology. And guess who they are? Both their last names begin with the letter L. You've got LaHaye and then Lindsay. Pessimillennialism. And so how does Gentry resolve the tension? How does he resolve the tension between his desire to see the church experience long-term cultural progress on one end of the stick and the reality that Christ comes back first before the kingdom age is set up? How would you resolve that tension? Well, he takes Revelation's prophecies and puts them into the past. That's what we call preterism. He doesn't take all of them and put them into the past, but he takes the great bulk of the prophecies of Revelation and puts them into the past and argues that these prophecies were fulfilled in the events surrounding the fall of Jerusalem in AD 70. So that just gives you a little bit of the mindset of the man as we critique some of his work here in these two sessions. So what we're going to be asking is this question. Is Gentry correct in arguing that the prophecies of the beast of Revelation were fulfilled in the person of Nero? Is that correct? And we're going to be analyzing that. But before we can even get to that point, we have to understand his assumptions. See, he's making certain assumptions about the book of Revelation. We've got to set the stage properly by understanding the assumptions that he makes about the book of Revelation. Gentry makes four assumptions. And so we're going to briefly go over these four assumptions in this session. And then in my second session, which I think is tomorrow, we'll be taking a look at how he interprets the text of Revelation. But what are his assumptions that he is making about the book of Revelation? You see them there listed in the left-hand column. Rather than seeing the theme of Revelation as the second coming of Christ, he sees the theme of Revelation as the Jewish war of AD 66 to 70. Rather than viewing Revelation's so-called time texts, and I'll explain what these mean as we get into this, rather than viewing them qualitatively, he views them chronologically. Rather than dating the book of Revelation late, he dates it early. And rather than viewing the book of Revelation as prophecy, his operating modus operandi is to view the book of Revelation as primarily apocalyptic rather than prophecy. And so all I'm going to do in this session is march through these four assumptions to give us a little bit of familiarity with how he thinks. And I'm also going to try to show how each of the assumptions that he's making here are actually inadequate. And the data, the information, favors the right-hand side of the column. Whoops, I got my rights and my lefts mixed up there. Backwards on the screen. The futurist side of the column. Okay, so that's kind of where we are going. You might want to grab your Bible and turn to Revelation chapter 1, verse 7. And let's take a look at his first assumption that he is making about the book. He sees the theme of the book as the Jewish war of AD 66 to 70. Revelation chapter 1, verse 7. I'm just going to read this verse to you. It says, "Behold, he is coming with the clouds, and every eye will see him, even those who pierced him. And all the tribes of the earth will mourn because of him. Even so, amen." He picks this now as a theme verse for the book. And at this point, I would agree. You could use this, Revelation chapter 1, verse 7, as a theme verse for the book. But we would disagree concerning the meaning that he's pouring into this particular verse. He's arguing that this verse teaches that the theme of Revelation is not the second coming of Jesus Christ, but rather it is the fall of Jerusalem, the events surrounding the fall of Jerusalem in AD 70. It is the judgment that was brought upon the Jews, brought upon Israel because of their rejection of their own Messiah. And so when the Roman armies came and invaded Israel and destroyed the temple and so forth in AD 70, he views that as the judgment of God that was brought upon the Jewish nation because of their rejection of their own Messiah. And based on that theme, the whole rest of the book, at least through chapter 19, is a description of those events. And this is where his replacement theology kicks in. I'm sure most people are familiar with the term replacement theology. It's the idea that the church has permanently replaced Israel in God's program. The church now has become the new Israel. The promises that were given to Israel have now been transferred to the church. And when, according to Gentry, when God brought judgment upon Israel in AD 70, he was eliminating the last vestige of Judaism, which was the functioning temple. Now, immediately, this should strike fear into your hearts, because what we've got here is an assault on God's character. Listen, if God cannot keep his promises to Israel, his unconditional, uncovenanted promises to Israel, what in the world makes us think that he can keep his promises to us? See, a little bit of replacement theology immediately casts aspersions into God's character. But how does he get there? And by the way, let me just say this. He will view the seven sealed scroll in Revelation chapter 6 as God's divorce decree. God divorced the nation of Israel and raised up the church, which is the new Israel. Now, what does he do here? What he's going to do in verse 7 is he's going to grab four words or concepts. The first one is clouds. He'll say, look, clouds in the Old Testament can depict God's coming judgment on a particular locality. He'll grab Isaiah 19:1, for example. And he'll say, look, cloud imagery is being used here, so obviously the same thing is happening. God is judging, bringing judgment on a particular locality. And then he'll grab the phrase, even they who pierced him. He'll say that's a reference to Israel. Israel killed their Messiah, and so now God is bringing judgment upon the nation. And then he'll grab the word tribes, and he'll find a few examples, you know, in the book of Revelation where tribes refers to the chosen people. For example, he'll go over to Revelation 7 where there's a discussion there of the 12 tribes of Israel. And he'll say tribes refers to Israel, and he'll bring this in and say, see, the Jewish people are here in focus. And then he'll focus on the word earth or land. And he'll find a few examples in the Old Testament and in the New Testament where earth or land can refer to the local land of Israel. See? And he kind of weaves this whole thing together in his book, The Beast of Revelation, and therefore comes up with this theme that the theme of Revelation is not the second coming of Christ, but it is the destruction of Israel in AD 70 because of Israel's rejection of their own Messiah. Now, there's so many problems with this. We could devote, you know, the whole conference to just Revelation chapter 1, verse 7. We're not going to do that. But very quickly, there's a phrase here, all the tribes of the earth. Greg Beale, in his commentary, points out that every time that phrase is used in the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Old Testament, every single time that phrase is used, it never has a local nuance. It always has a global nuance. It never refers to the tribes of Israel. It refers to the tribes of all the earth. But yet Gentry would have us believe that this same phrase, which is used so consistently referring to universality all the way through the Septuagint, somehow now refers to a local event. See? Another problem we could point out is his use of the term land or earth. Now it's true, land or earth in some contexts can refer to the local land of Israel. But in other contexts, it doesn't. In other contexts, the word has a global, universal meaning. For example, in Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, in the Septuagint, what does it say? In the beginning, God created the heavens and the what? The earth. There the term is being used in a universal way. So the term could be global, Or it could be local in some context. Matthew 2:6, the term is used locally. So which meaning do we use? What's the key word? Context tells us. The context here and the context of the book is global and universal. All the way through the book of Revelation, we see these global judgments. The global meaning fits much better. But see, this is a key tactic that is used. When you run into words like this, he'll go give you a laundry list of scripture citations somewhere else in the Bible where the word can have a local meaning, and then he'll read that right back into his present context. I don't know if you've ever run across someone who wants to advocate that Noah's flood was a local event. There are people that push that idea. Noah's flood was not a global event. Noah's flood was a local event. Well, they've got this big problem. How do they explain away the global language in Genesis chapter 7? Well, you go to another context. Your current context doesn't support what you want to say, so you go to another context. And you grab a phrase, for example, in Genesis 41, verse 57. It talks about all the tribes of the earth, but in that remote context, all the tribes of the earth is talking about just the tribes in Egypt. So all has a local meaning. And then they take that understanding of all and they read it right back into Genesis chapter 7. See, that's a hermeneutical error James Barr called illegitimate totality transfer. Words should be determined by their own context rather than by some remote context. But this is the type of thing that you run into in preterist writings. This is one of the tactics that's used to take what's obviously global language and make it local language. So there's a few problems here with his first assumption that the theme of the book of Revelation is not the second coming, but rather it's the Jewish war of AD 66 to 70. Let's go on to the second assumption. Second assumption revolves around what they call the time texts of Revelation. Now that word, time text, is not our word, it's their word. We don't really believe these texts are time texts. But for example, Revelation has all these interesting little words in play here. We see the word takos, which can, in some contexts, mean shortly or quickly. We see the word agos, which can, in some contexts, mean near or at hand. We see the word mellow, which can, in some contexts, mean something that's about to happen. And so what preterists do is they come in now and they attach a chronological significance to these contexts. And they begin to argue from these texts that these words, shortly, quickly, near, at hand, on the point of, and so forth, teach that the prophecies of the book of Revelation had to have been fulfilled within the lifespan of John's original audience. And so, for example, we have Gary DeMar, who likes to make fun of us, you know, because supposedly we're the literal interpreters of Scripture, but he criticizes us because we're not interpreting these time texts literally, in his mind. So he has this statement, he says, "How consistent are dispensationalists in following the literal plane or normal hermeneutical model when they deny the literal plane or normal interpretation of near, shortly, and quickly?" Now this on its face is a ridiculous statement, because as I'll show in just a moment, we do interpret the time text literally, because literal means normal usage. I guess we could ask DeMar the same question: why do you interpret the book of Revelation allegorically, but these things literally? But I'm just throwing these quotes up here to give us a little bit of insight into how these people think. And this fact, this chronological understanding of these time texts, controls their exegesis. So they would reject outright the idea that the beast is someone that's coming in the future tribulation period. They would reject outright our view, which teaches that the beast will arise in Daniel's future 70th week. They would totally reject that. Why? Because they say that violates a chronological understanding of these time texts. So, for example, Gentry in his book says this principle alone, and when he says this principle, he's referring to a chronological understanding of the time texts, this principle alone will eliminate 99.9% of the suggestions by both prophecy populace and even competent commentators. So this idea that there's a beast that's coming in the future is totally rejected by them, because they would say that's 2,000 years or more removed from John's original audience, and that violates some kind of chronological understanding of the time texts. And we would have several problems with how they're interpreting these time texts. Dr. Mal Couch has written a whole chapter in the new book edited by Ice and LaHaye on these time texts. And he shows over and over again that lexically it's possible to interpret them qualitatively rather than chronologically. In other words, it's describing how an event happens or the manner in which an event happens rather than when it will happen. Takos can, in some contexts, be understood as when the events happen, they're going to pass with great velocity. When the event happens, it'll come quickly. Acts 22:18 is an example of that. Or agos can refer to something that's certain. Something will certainly come. And Hebrews 7:22 gives a parallel word which has that same meaning. And the word mellow, the participle form that's used in Revelation 3:10, is also used over in Romans 8:18 to describe something that's inevitable. Paul in Romans 8:18 uses the participle of mellow to show that our future glorification as believers is something that's predestined. When he used that participle, he wasn't saying, look, your future glorification is going to occur within your lifespan. That wasn't what he was saying. He was saying your future glorification is something that's unavoidable. It's inevitable. In fact, it's elected. It's predestined. And so it's very easy to read these time texts in Revelation the same way. And Tommy has an article in the Conservative Theological Journal in which he shows that these same words have this annoying habit of showing up in the Septuagint in contexts where it's impossible to give these words a chronological meaning. For example, Takos shows up in Isaiah 51:5 describing the day of the Lord or the righteousness of the Lord and how the righteousness of the Lord is near. But if you look at the context of Isaiah 51, it's obvious that these prophecies weren't fulfilled within Isaiah's lifetime because they're millennial. See? Same thing with Agos. Agos shows up in Joel chapter 3 in a context where it's describing the future day of the Lord. when Joel when that particular word is used in the Septuagint, it's not saying that these prophecies are going to be fulfilled within Joel's lifespan. Rather, it's communicating the idea of certainty. So the point I'm trying to make here is these time texts, you know, preterist writings, make a big deal about these things. And they act like their understanding of these time texts is the only way to read the text. It's not true. There are other interpretive options. These things can be understood chronologically in some contexts, but qualitatively in others. Now, what makes the choice for us? The context that we're working in. The context of Revelation is global events. These things haven't happened yet. So it's obvious that these time texts should be understood in more of a qualitative manner than a chronological manner. Let me kind of move on here. By the way, these texts create big problems for them. More problems for them than for us. Because Gentry is what we call a partial preterist. He believes that most of Revelation's prophecies were fulfilled in AD 70, but he leaves a few shreds for the end. I think he still believes in a future resurrection. He believes in a future parousia or coming of Christ. He believes in a future judgment. But if he interprets these time texts the same way at the end of the book of Revelation that he interprets them in chapter 1, he would have to argue that the whole book of Revelation has been fulfilled. Logically, that's where his interpretation would lead, and he doesn't want to go there. Because now he starts running afoul of the great, you know, ecumenical creeds of the church, and people can accuse him of being a full preterist. So he's carved out this little niche for himself called partial preterism, where you can interpret most of the events of Revelation as in the past, but save a few shreds of truth for the end and still call yourself orthodox. But to get there, he's got to view these time texts inconsistently. Well, hopefully I haven't confused everybody. Let's move on to the next assumption that they're making. The third assumption that's made has to do with the date of the book of Revelation. When was the book of Revelation written? They would argue for an early date. I personally hold to a later date. Why should we care about this? What do we mean, first of all, by early date? Early date would refer to the mid-60s during the reign of Nero. A later date would refer to the 90s, probably 95 or 96, during the reign of Domitian. Well, why should there be a concern over this? Well, obviously, the book of Revelation cannot be a prophecy about the events surrounding the fall of Jerusalem in AD 70 if the book was written after AD 70. It's kind of hard for the book to be a prophecy about the events of AD 70 if the book was written in the 90s. And so the preterist position is dependent upon this early date. Any type of preterist work that comes out today, arguing the type of preterism that Gentry espouses, will have to spend half the book arguing for Revelation's early date. For example, in this book that we're critiquing, The Beast of Revelation, Gentry spends half of it trying to convince the reader that the book of Revelation was written early rather than late because his position is tied to this early date. Now, our view, is it affected by the date? No, you can believe the prophecies of Revelation are future and hold to a late date. You can believe the prophecies of the book of Revelation are future and hold to an early date. They don't have that luxury. And so R.C. Sproul, for example, makes this statement. He says, if the book of Revelation was written after A.D. 70, then its contents manifestly do not refer to the fall of Jerusalem, unless the book is a wholesale fraud, having been composed after the predicted events had already occurred. There he's admitting his dependence upon an early date. There was a thesis, master's thesis, that was just posted on Bible.org. And in this particular thesis, the author argues that the prophecies about Babylon were fulfilled in the events surrounding the fall of Jerusalem in AD 70. So what does this author do of this particular master's thesis? He has to do what Gentry does. He spends half of the book, or half of the thesis, half of his work, trying to convince the reader for an early date. And this is a big problem for them, because most contemporary New Testament scholars are not going to date the book that early. Most hold to a later date for Revelation, or a Domitianic date for Revelation. And Gentry, in his book, The Beast of Revelation, comes out and admits this. He says, look, I know I'm swimming here upstream against the tide of opinion. So he admits it, but then he tries to kind of camouflage the issue by citing scholar after scholar after scholar that supposedly agrees with him. Scholars that hold to a pre-AD 70 date for the date of the book of Revelation. What he's not telling you, and Mark Hitchcock brings this out in his chapter of the book End Times Controversy, what he's not telling you is most of the scholars that he cites while dating the book pre-AD 70 will not go as early as Gentry wants to go into the mid-60s. See, Gentry's got to go with the date into the mid-60s, not just pre-AD 70. Because he's trying to make the book of Revelation a prophecy about the events of Nero's reign, which ended in 68. The last 3 years, or 3.5 years of Nero's reign, which ended in 68. He's got to take the book very early into AD 65. In one place of his writings, he says maybe even 64 AD. And most of these scholars that he cites that supposedly agree with him will not take the date that early. And so I think that's something, you know, that we need to keep in mind when you read Gentry's work and you see this long list of scholars, you know, that supposedly agree with him. Well, they don't agree with him because they're not going to take the date as early as he wants to take it. Now, real quickly, how do we date a book? What criteria do we use to date a book of the Bible? Well, there's two things. Number one, we're going to look at the external evidence, or evidence from outside the book. And secondly, we'll take a look at the internal evidence, or evidence from within the book. Let's talk about the external evidence just real quickly. Gentry cannot cite a single external source that favors an early date, that favors a Neronic date, unambiguously, until the year 550. He tries to cite sources prior to 550 regarding the early date for the book of Revelation. The problem is, all of the people he cites before 550, scholars have given that particular external source multiple interpretations. Late date advocates can say, no, the source is teaching this. Early date advocates say, no, the source is teaching this. It's ambiguous evidence. It's not until the year 550 that he has the first uncontested, ambiguous source of external evidence regarding the early date for the book of Revelation. Now, this is to be contrasted with the external evidence for the late date. The external evidence for the late date enjoys a long line of support going all the way back to Irenaeus, and even before Irenaeus. But we just stop here at Irenaeus, since I borrowed this chart from Mark Hitchcock. But notice that the evidence for a Domitianic date, or a late date, goes all the way back to AD 180. Now, who was Irenaeus? Was he just some guy that really, you know, knew very little about the date of the book of Revelation? No, Irenaeus was discipled by a man named Polycarp. Polycarp, in turn, was discipled by a man named John. John wrote the book of Revelation. Irenaeus is one generation removed from John. So it would stand to reason that Irenaeus would know something about the date of the book of Revelation. Let's talk about the internal evidence for a second. Why don't you grab your Bibles and turn over to Revelation chapter 17. Let's look at some of the internal arguments that he relies on. Revelation chapter 17. Look at verses 9 and 10. Verse 9, we have the seven hills. And here Gentry agrees with Dave Hunt that the seven hills represent the seven hills of Rome. I just kind of throw that in because I don't think they care much for Dave Hunt. It's always interesting to show how they end up agreeing with Dave Hunt on a few things. I like Dave Hunt too, by the way. But he takes the view that the seven hills are the seven hills of Rome. And then in verse 10, we have a description of the seven kings. And he takes these seven kings as seven kings of Rome. And he says, look very carefully at verse 10. Five of the kings have fallen. One of the kings is. In other words, Gentry says, one of these kings was in power when John wrote this book. This is how he's thinking now. One of these kings is in power when John wrote this book. So all we got to do to figure out the date of Revelation is figure out who that one king was and when he wrote. And excuse me, not when he wrote, when he reigned, and that will help us date the book. And so he starts counting kings. He starts with Julius Caesar, and then he counts five kings into the future, and he arrives at Nero as the sixth reigning king, and he says, look, Nero reigned from AD 54 to AD 68, therefore obviously the book of Revelation was written prior to AD 68. That favors an early date for the book of Revelation. That's the type of evidence that he is relying on. Well, there's a lot of problems with this. Why does he start the count with Julius Caesar? Why not start it with Augustus? Augustus was the first reigning king. Or, for that matter, why don't we start with Caligula? He was the first persecuting king. And how many of these kings should we be counting anyway? Should we count the ones that just emphasized emperor worship? Should we just count the ones who were persecuting kings? And how about the minor kings that reigned for a short period of time? Are we going to count them? And so what I'm trying to show you is there's a total lack of consensus in the commentaries regarding how these kings should be counted. This is a chart from David Onney's commentary. And you see the kings there. And up on the top are all of the different methods that scholars have come up with for counting these kings. And so you cannot build a case for dating the book of Revelation on Revelation chapter 17, verses 9 and 10, because there is widespread disagreement on how the kings should be counted. And for that matter, I'm not even convinced that these kings are kings at all. It's quite likely that these kings are kingdoms. This is the view of Robert Thomas. This is the view of John Walvoord. Mountains in the Old Testament typically refer to kingdoms. And so John Walvoord and Robert Thomas believe these are the seven kingdoms, rather than kings, kingdoms which have persecuted Israel throughout her history. Egypt, Assyria, Medo-Persia, Greece, Babylon, Rome, and the seventh kingdom would be revived Rome. So all I'm trying to show you is these are the types of arguments that are relied on regarding the internal evidence, but it's not very convincing. Another argument he relies on, why don't you flip over to Revelation 11. Revelation 11, notice verses 1 and 2. Revelation 11, 1 and 2, it talks there about a temple. And here's Gentry's thinking on this. A temple is mentioned here. Therefore, the temple obviously was standing when John wrote. Okay? The temple is destroyed in AD 70, historically. So therefore, obviously, the book of Revelation must have been written prior to AD 70. And there's so many holes in this, it's difficult to know where to begin. For example, isn't it possible for a biblical writer, under the power of the Spirit of God, under a vision from the Spirit of God, to talk about a temple that's in the distant future when no temple was currently standing at the time the book was written or at the time the biblical writer received the vision? Doesn't Daniel do that? Daniel writes at a time when the nation had gone into captivity. The temple had been destroyed. And yet in the book of Daniel, what do we find? We find four references to a temple in a vision. Chapter 8, there's a reference to a temple. Chapter 11, there's a reference to a temple. That would be a reference to a temple that would exist about 400 years into the future that Antiochus would desecrate. Chapter 9 and chapter 12, we have references to a temple. That would be the future tribulation temple that the Antichrist will desecrate. So the point I'm trying to make here is you cannot use something like this to date the book of Revelation, because it's common for biblical writers, particularly prophets, to receive a vision in the distant future about a temple yet to exist when no temple was actually in existence at the time the vision was given. How about the book of Ezekiel? Ezekiel, the last part of the book, Ezekiel writes after the nation had gone into captivity and the temple had been destroyed, yet Ezekiel talks about a future millennial temple. He writes about that temple under a vision from God. And why can't John be doing the same thing here? And while we're on the subject of internal evidence, the internal evidence actually ends up supporting the late date. Why? Because of the condition of the seven churches of Asia Minor. We know, for example, that there was a great earthquake. We know this from the writings of Tacitus, that there was a great earthquake in AD 60, which destroyed the city of Laodicea. Yet, Revelation chapter 3, verse 17 depicts the city of Laodicea and the church of Laodicea as enjoying great prosperity. Now, Gentry wants to date the book of Revelation in AD 65, but wouldn't it have taken more than 5 years for the city to be rebuilt and to begin to prosper again after such a terrible earthquake? We know from archaeology that it took this city several decades to recover. Colin Hammer, who's done a lot of work on this, talks about how it took, based on the archaeological evidence, decades for the city to recover. But how could it have recovered in such a short time? So the point I'm making is, although Gentry will bring out these internal evidence arguments, the internal evidence actually ends up favoring the late date rather than the earlier date. A much stronger case can be made. Let's move now to the fourth and final assumption that Gentry is making about the book of Revelation. The first one was the theme of Revelation is the Jewish War of AD 66 to 70. The second one involves a chronological understanding of the time text. The third assumption he makes is that the book was written early rather than late. And then finally we have this fourth assumption, and this has to do with the genre in which Revelation was written. Genre, that's a French term or word. It refers to a category or a class, a particular class of literature. And let me show you real quickly how this works. If you take the literal, grammatical, historical method of interpretation, the method of interpretation which says we are going to interpret words in their ordinary sense unless there's an obvious symbol or figure of speech, and sometimes we're accused of not recognizing symbols or figures of speech, which is laughable because Bullinger has written the greatest academic treatment on figures of speech in print. And guess what Bullinger was? A dispensationalist. One of us doing this great treatment on figures of speech. And I just throw that in because we're often criticized for not recognizing symbols and figures of speech. But if you take the literal, grammatical, historical method and you apply it to the book of Revelation, you will end up a futurist. You will not end up a preterist. Why? Because the events of the book haven't happened yet. It's quite obvious. Has the world's half of the world's population been destroyed? No. Has the sea turned to blood? No. Has the greatest earthquake in human history happened yet? No. How can you take this global language and apply it to the local events of AD 70. Charles Clough, in one of his teaching tapes, has a word for this. It's a highly technical, theological phrase. He calls it the ram, jam, and cram method. to take this global language and put it back into AD 70, you've got to ram, jam, and cram. Now, how in the world would a preterist answer this? What they would say is, in Revelation, we're not going to apply the literal grammatical historical method of interpretation. Well, why not? Well, because the book of Revelation is a special type of literature in which you can't interpret it the way you would interpret Romans or some other book. Now, when I use the term apocalyptic literature, in one sense, we all believe the book of Revelation is apocalyptic literature, because the very first word in the book is apocalypsis, which means a disclosure. But that's not how the term is being used today. The way the term is being used today is apocalyptic literature refers to a group of books or a series of books that arose in the intertestamental period and into the first century. And these books have a certain cluster of characteristics. They were written about the same general time period. They featured angels as interpreters and guides. They were written during times of intense persecution. They used vivid images and symbols. They depicted the struggle between good and evil. They used visions as a means of revelation. They focused upon the current age and the inauguration of the age to come. There was a dualism between God and Satan. There was a predetermined spiritual order and a pessimistic view of man's ability to change the events of history. That's apocalyptic literature. And I would have to concur that Revelation shares some of these features. But what people are starting to do now is they want to take the book of Revelation and lump it in with all of these books. They say, look, Revelation was written in the same time period, generally speaking. Revelation shares many of these characteristics, so let's just kind of throw it in with the rest. And the moment you do that is the moment you're making a decision with respect to how the book is to be interpreted. You cannot use the literal grammatical historical method if you believe Revelation is apocalyptic literature the way that I've described it here. Because in apocalyptic writings, Babylon was used as a code word for Rome. In apocalyptic writings, they took a minor local event and blew it up hyperbolically to make it seem like a global event. And what people are starting to argue is, look, the book of Revelation is just like these other books. So just as you can't use the literal grammatical historical method with respect to these other books, you can't use it with respect to Revelation. So Steve Gregg, a preterist, says, a failure to take into account this feature has led to some of the most outlandish teachings on this book by some whose only rule of interpretation is literal and less absurd. Now, who's he talking about there? The Disbys. I use that because Gary DeMar used that phrase, Disby. Though this is a good rule, when dealing with literature written in a literal genre, it is the exact opposite in the case of apocalyptic literature, where symbolism is the rule and literalism is the exception. You see what he's done there? We believe you take the text literally unless there's an obvious symbol or figure of speech. What he's done is switch those two. Symbolism is now the rule, and literalism becomes the exception. So Gentry, when he gets into a tight spot, when the global language of the text doesn't line up with AD 70, he'll say, well, apocalyptic hyperbole is being used. So, for example, Gentry says, the preterist view does understand Revelation's prophecies as strongly reflecting actual historical events in John's near future, though they are set in apocalyptic drama and clothed in poetic hyperbole. So in his commentary, for example, on Revelation 9, regarding the army of 200 million, how can you ram, jam, and cram that back into AD 70? Well, obviously, hyperbole is being used here. Revelation is written in the same style as all these other hyperbolic books, so we're just not going to interpret the text literally or using the literal grammatical historical method. Robert Thomas, who's in our camp, notices this trait amongst preterists. He says, a preterist approach must assume an apocalyptic genre in which the language only faintly and indirectly reflects the actual events. This extreme allegorical interpretation allows for finding fulfillments in the first century Roman Empire prior to the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. In other words, we lump Revelation in with a new genre, and we have to have now a new hermeneutic. Cannot use the literal grammatical historical method. And very quickly, what I'm trying to say here in this final point is that I disagree with the premise. I disagree with the premise that Revelation can just be thrown in with all of these other intertestamental apocalyptic writings. Why? Because there are key differences between Revelation and these apocalyptic writings. And this is a chart from Robert Thomas. And he compares now Revelation with apocalyptic writings. He says, look, these apocalyptic writings were pseudonymous. In other words, Enoch didn't write the book of Enoch. Someone pretending to be Enoch wrote the book of Enoch to give the book credibility. Is that what John is doing in Revelation? Of course not. The actual author is writing. In apocalyptic writings, you don't have any epistles. What do we have in Revelation 2 and 3? Seven epistles, seven letters to seven churches. In apocalyptic writings, you don't have admonitions for morality. At least those aren't very frequent. What do we have in the book of Revelation? Repent, 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 as Christ is speaking to the seven churches. Apocalyptic writings were pessimistic about the present. Is Revelation pessimistic about the present? Not in the same way, because it pictures the Lamb who was already broken into human history and paid the debt for the sins of the world. In apocalyptic writings, Messiah's coming is exclusively future. Is that what's portrayed in Revelation? No. It portrays Messiah's first coming as laying the foundation for the second coming. Apocalyptic writings of the intertestamental era don't claim to be prophecy. Yet what do we find repeated over and over again in the book of Revelation? John claims that the book that he is writing is prophecy. The apocalyptic writings of the intertestamental period were not divinely inspired. What is the book of Revelation? It's written under divine inspiration. The apocalyptic writings of the intertestamental period took a historical event or an event that happened in the past, and they portray it as if it was going to be a future event. What's happening? Is that what's happening in Revelation? No. John is actually seeing a future event under the inspiration of the Spirit of God. So the only point I'm trying to make here is that we don't throw out the literal, grammatical, historical method in interpreting Revelation under the assumption that Revelation is just like these other apocalyptic writings of the intertestamental period, because, as Robert Thomas shows us in this chart, there are key differences between Revelation and these other apocalyptic writings. So what I've tried to do in this session, just real briefly, as we're critiquing Gentry's book, The Beast of Revelation, is show you where he's coming from by taking you through some of his key assumptions. And I've tried to show you that many of the assumptions that he relies upon are not adequate. The book of Revelation is about the second coming of Christ, not the Jewish war of AD 66 to 70. The so-called time text of Revelation can be understood qualitatively rather than chronologically. Revelation was written late rather than early. The proper genre of Revelation should be understood as prophecy rather than apocalyptic literature, and we're not going to, in the process of calling it apocalyptic, discard the literal grammatical historical method. So I went through these quick, but these types of issues are dealt with more of a lengthy basis in the new book, End Times Controversy, edited by LaHaye and Ice. So in my next session, which will be tomorrow, we'll actually look at the text of Revelation 13 and try to get a handle on how Gentry interprets that particular text now that we understand some of his working assumptions. So I'm finished.